Good morning. My name is Sharon Townsend. I'm part of the Connections team. I'm in a small group, and I'm also involved in women's ministry. And this morning's passage is going to sound familiar from last Sunday. Zach will be doing part B. Okay. 1 Corinthians 13. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. If I give away all I have, and if I deliver up my body to be burned, but have not love, I gain nothing. Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. As for prophecies, they will pass away. As for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part, but when the perfect comes, the partial will pass away. When I was a child, I spoke like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I gave up childish ways. For now we see in the mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I have been fully known. So now faith, hope, and love abide, these three, but the greatest of these is love.
Well, there are many definitions about what love is like. How would you describe it? What does it entail? How do we know if it's real? When you ask our philosophers, our poets, and there seems to be little agreement on what is the nature of love. Some focus on the eternality of it, describing it as endless love, or the irresistibility of it, saying, I can't help falling in love with you, to the point to where all of me loves all of you. Or there's the exclusivity of it, that they don't love you like I love you, which makes sense once we understand the power of love. But that power is not always a good thing. To some, love is a battlefield. Love hurts when these things aren't true, when things have been ended with somebody, someone you loved. And it leaves people crazy in love. After all, it is a crazy little thing. But it can be a force for good. Love will keep us together, especially when you have love on the brain. But it just gets the difficulty and confusing nature of the whole thing. For some, love is like a rocket. For others, it's more like a love roller coaster. It just leaves people throwing up their hands saying, ah, that's what love is. All this leaves people confused, pleading, I want to know what love is. I want you to show me. Or even questioning its purpose, saying, what's love got to do with it? Just left with the mystery of love, wondering where is their love story. We spent time last week looking about how the church, every church more than anything, is to be known by its love. And that was particularly pressing in the church in Corinth that was divided. They were at odds over just about every possible category that they could be. And it came to a head when the church started to compare against each other to see who had the more miraculous gifts, who was more impressive, and thinking that that made them better, that their giftedness was what defined them more than anything else. And Paul says, no, the church is to be known by its love. Everything else will fade away, but love will remain. Now, I recognize as we talk about love, it could sound a little bit ethereal, like something out there, not really tangible. You can't grasp it. What does it fully mean? I mean, if we can't even agree on what love is like, how do we grow in this way that we're called to? I mean, even these songs that we sing get to this angst, get to this confusion, this lack of understanding. In this culture that we're in that values love above all else, prizes it. We use it in slogans. We say that it's always needed, that it's the height of value in our society. We still struggle to define it, to recognize, to agree on what it's like. Well, this is where I'm grateful for 1 Corinthians 13. This chapter that's given to us that not only tells us the nature of love, but also the source of love, what it's like and where it comes from. And all this confusion, to have a chapter like this is a literal godsend. But before we jump too much into the details of it, we should probably speak of the overarching ideas before we get lost in the details of it, to understand the bigger picture idea of what Paul is talking about, what love is like. Because there's two big camps that are at odds against each other on this important of topics. You have people who are asked, what is love, or where does it come from? And it's the focus on the feelings, the emotions that we have towards someone else. Other people say, no, it's not enough to have these feelings. It's what we do. It's these actions that we take. So you have these two sides that are debating, where is the source of love? Is it in what we feel or what we do? And Paul's answer is, yep. Love is emotionally driven. It is the feelings of affection and desire that we have towards other people. And yet love is action-packed. It is about what we do for others. Essentially, it boils down to love is a way of being, our entire selves, all of our lives, that resides in our emotions and is lived out in our actions. As Paul describes what love is like in chapter 13, he says it's a way of being, our entire life directed in love, that resides in our emotions, our affections, and is lived out in our actions. And this runs a bit contrary to how some people talk about love, to where it can almost feel like we're out of control with it. We're just victims of love. We can't help where it's directed. We can't help where it goes. Where love happens, well, that's just where it is. Who are we to say otherwise? But no, love is something that's given to us. Sure, there's a source of what it's brought forth, but we're not victims of it. It's not an accident. Love is something that's willingly acted upon. Our emotions directed towards someone and our actions put in that same place. But chapter 13 as well is a broadening of how we are to love, but also who we are to love. This chapter is written to the church. 1 Corinthians 13 is given to the church to describe how the church is to love those in the church. Not just some, not just those who are really gifted at it, but all of the church. And not just loving a few people, those that we get along with, or we're in a similar age group, or we're in a small group with them. No, Paul is describing how all the church is to love all the church. And so what is this love like? What is the nature of this love? Well, we start by saying love is patient. It waits for others. It patiently puts up with quirks and idiosyncrasies, and mistakes and failures, differences and difficulties. Love doesn't jump to conclusions or accusations. This has been a growing place for me. I mean, you can't do anything but grow in patience when you have an 11-month-old. And it's never been a strong suit for me. I've never been the most patient person. But I've been really surprised by how I can maintain my cool and my gentleness towards Everett in times that he is really testing my patience. But then the illusion is quickly shattered as I get really short and frustrated with someone else. Love is being patient with all people, those that we naturally have affection for and those that we very much so don't. Or on the other side of it, to be patient with those who are new to us, or those that we have a long history with, and that's led to us having a short fuse. Love is patient. Love is kind, showing mercy and goodness and compassion and forgiveness of others. Love considers the needs of other people instinctually. This isn't something that we need to carve out time for on our calendar to remember it. We don't need to put reminders on our phone to, all right, care for other people. No, love is naturally kind for others. With the ease at which we think about our own needs, love considers the needs of others. Love does not envy. We kick off a run of descriptions of what love is not like. Sometimes when something is so beautiful or pure or difficult to describe, it's easier to focus on what is it not like, to rule out what it's not in order to better understand what it is. To say what something is not to understand what it actually is like is the easiest way to do it. I mean, think about the ways that we describe God. God is infinite is one. He's not finite. What does that look like? I don't know, but we know what it's like to be finite. So we say God is infinite to say he's other than that. What is love like? I don't know, but it's not envious. I could tell you that much. Love does not look at what other people have and wish that that was theirs for themselves at the expense of others. Love does not look with envy and wishing that this thing that other people have was actually mine. It would be better if it was mine. This could be recognition that someone gets. And rather than rejoicing with them that their hard work has paid off, thinking, well, that should be me. I should be up there right now. Or looking at how other kids are behaving and rather than rejoicing in the gift of our kids, thinking, why aren't you more like them? Or when someone has the ability to buy a house or a bigger home or whatever it might be, rather than rejoicing in the happiness of others, to think, you know what actually would make me happy? Is if I had what you had instead. Love does not boast. This is the flip side of envy. This is when I have something and you don't, and I'm gonna use that as a time to compare, to contrast, and look at me. I'm up here and you're down there. To use what we have to elevate ourselves at the expense of other people. Now, rather, love is a place of, it seeks a place of harmony, of humility. And not just looking at how do I respond in this situation, but so aware of other people that I'm not gonna try to create this as a place of envy for you. I'm gonna be so considerate of you that I'm, even though I have something here, I'm gonna do what I can to not push you towards envy yourself. To put these two positively then, what does it mean that love does not envy or does not boast? Love is content. It is satisfied. It knows exactly that where I am, God has me here. That who I am, God has made me this person. That I don't need to look around. I don't need to look at what I might be missing out on or what I can point out that you don't have. Love is content, and that's what allows us to not be envious or boast. Love is not arrogant. Paul's been using this word arrogant many times throughout this letter, chapters 4 and chapters 8 in particular. He's called out this church in Corinth for this arrogance that they have, saying that it puffs up. It makes them falsely inflated, thinking that they are better off than they are. And they've been doing this as they're comparing, as they're contrasting, as they're thinking that they are better over these other Christians who are theirs, emphasizing their superiority when Paul says, no, love instead seeks harmony, seeks reconciliation, seeks togetherness. Love is not rude. We are not lacking in concern of other people. What this means is that people are not merely pieces that are part of our life. They're not merely just tiny little pieces on which the rest of my life gets lived. They're not bit players. They're not NPCs. They're not decor or whatever it is that we might look at others on. They are the focal point. Others are the main thing. And so we seek not to offend or to overlook or to be obscene towards others. Love does not insist on its own way. There's no place for the statements like my way or the highway. You need to get along with what I want or what I need or what I say is right. Otherwise, we're gonna have a breaking point here. Now, the idea is that our satisfaction cannot rest solely in what one other person can do for us or what other people can do for us. We don't insist upon what feels right for ourselves. That is not the nature of love. This is one of the, I don't know, 10,000 or so ways that I cannot be a great husband sometimes. There's moments where I come home after having a tough day and then Emily has the audacity to not have a good day herself. No. This is about me. I get to be the focus. You're supposed to be caring for me right now. I mean, how many relationships do we hear break down when something like, well, I just wasn't feeling it anymore. I just wasn't getting out of it what I thought I would have or what I used to get out of it. Then it wasn't love. Because the nature of love is not asking, what can you do for me? but what can I do for you? How can I meet your ways, your needs? Love does not insist upon its own way. It is not irritable. It is not quick to anger, quick to fly off the handle, which can often happen if we don't feel good about ourselves. If the place that we are in, it almost has nothing to do with what other people are doing. If I am not satisfied, if I am not in a good spot, then that's going to make me angry. That's going to make me fly off the handle. I'm going to want revenge. I'm going to lash out. I'm going to put other people down when I am not in a good space. Love instead recognizes that no matter what circumstances I am in, I'm going to treat you as the focal point rather than lashing out or getting revenge or putting you down. I mean, we see this a lot. Again, to use an example with parents, like when a child is not acting in the way that the parent wants them to, and shame or embarrassment or whatever it is winning out over love in that day, then there starts to be the yelling. Why aren't you doing what you're supposed to be doing? Or in the church, when we have set expectations about what the church must be doing, how I want things to be done, and when that's not happening, why aren't you doing what you're supposed to be doing? And the church begins to break down. Love is not resentful. It doesn't keep score. It doesn't keep a record of wrongs to the point to where when there's an argument or a fight that breaks out, you're no longer fighting about that one thing anymore, but you're bringing the whole history. All of it is coming out, and it snowballs into a massive thing. Starts in one small piece and just ignites the entire forest. One spark ignites the whole forest. It's to the point that I've heard people describe it as when people get angry or upset, some get hysterical, others get historical. Just bringing out the record of wrongs, all that has gone wrong that either relates to it of when this has been done in the past or what feels similar. I felt hurt like this back then. And it was never resolved. It was held on to, and resentment grew rather than love. It's why Paul writes elsewhere in Ephesians 4 to not let the sun go down on your anger, to not let this fester, to not let this continue on. It doesn't mean that you need to solve it right then and there. I'm often ill-equipped to do so. I'm often not in a good spot. I'm going to be irritable and go off the handle. And so I need to take a breath. I need to walk. I need to calm down in that time. But if we just leave it there, if we just let this grow, then love's not going to grow. It's going to be resentful. There's going to be this record of wrongs. Love does not rejoice at wrongdoing. That is, it doesn't delight in what goes against God or goes against his church. That when we see people doing what God clearly says not to do or going against the church that God says he cares about, we don't join in. We don't think that looks fun. I'm going to be part of it. Or the other side of it, and one that I think is perhaps a bigger correction for the church, one that I see far too often, is when we see people who have gone against what God says or gone against the church, and then they get theirs, oh, the smiles on our faces, the looks of glee and delight. That's rejoicing in wrongdoing. That we are joining in this lack of love for this person. Love does not delight in sin or the results of sin, but instead rejoices with the truth. I think these two rejoices point to one of two ways that we tend to err. I don't know what it is for you, but one of two ways that we tend to fall on one side over the other. One could be that we are good at rejoicing in the truth. We hold people accountable to what God has clearly said, but we don't do so out of love and care for the other person. And so we join in the wrongdoing. Or the other side, we care about this person, and out of love, we want to show concern. And so the loving thing is to remain silent here. Yeah, they're doing something wrong, but I'm not going to bring that up. I'm not going to make waves. I'm not going to make things difficult for them. Out of love, I'm not going to speak the truth. And that's not it. Love rejoices in the truth. Because what we're doing in that time when we don't correct people, when we don't hold each other accountable to what God says is true and right and good, we're not showing love for the other person. We're showing love for ourselves, for the comfort that we have right now. We don't want to make things difficult. So that's not love for this other person. Love bears all things. We recognize that love takes time. This isn't speaking of something that we just do once or periodically or every so often we'll be patient and kind. No, this is something that takes time, like all things that are good do. It bears things, no matter what. Love is the response. Our lives are marked by it. Love believes all things. Now, this isn't speaking about relativism. Oh, that's your truth, and that's good for you. I believe that that's fine for you. Or just blindly trusting in what people say. Well, he said he didn't abuse her, and the loving thing was to take him at his word. No, that's not saying that by believing in all things. Remember, we said love rejoices in the truth, so we seek to go for what is true. But rather, when it says that love believes all things, that we never run out of trust. We never run out of faith of the goodness that God has made this person to be. That even if their actions are not good, that God has still made them good and worthwhile. See, there's never something that anyone can do that makes them too far gone. There's never anything that any person can do that makes them unworthy of being loved. Love believes all things. And so similarly, love hopes all things. We never stop hoping in what God might do for this person that we love. This is talking about the church, but if we step outside of that, we never stop loving our child who no longer attends church, and we hope for the day that they will turn back to God. We never stop loving our friend who doesn't see a reason to wish or hope for anything more than what's in this physical world, this fleeting world that we have. Why should we look beyond this for anything more? And we hope that they will see the abundant life that's offered in Jesus. We never stop loving our coworker who says that Christianity is just a relationship with an imaginary friend. That the only reason why Christians do anything good at all is because we're afraid of God. And we hope for them to see that we don't live out of fear, but there's true and genuine and necessary transformation that can happen because of what Jesus has done for us. And the hope that we have for those outside the church is the same hope that we have here. Because we're going to hurt each other. We're going to be disappointed. We're going to be let down. And yet we never run out of hope that God can bring reconciliation and restoration and goodness with one another. Love endures all things. All this is to say that love is not the soft option. This is a difficult route to take. Because love is in it for the long haul, unwavering, no matter what is thrown at it. We have these 15 descriptions of what love is like here. And one of the things that struck me as I was reading through it this time, as we've been working through the book of 1 Corinthians together, I've just jumped to this chapter. I've looked at it out of context. But as we've been working through the context, one thing emerged to me that I don't think I ever realized before. This feels like a summary of all the chapters that we've had before this one. As we've worked through 12 chapters of what's going on in the city of Corinth, the brokenness that this church has been experiencing, the pain and difficulty that they've had, all the while Paul is saying that the church is to be known by its love, as every single church is to be known by its love. As we read this list, it was making me think, the church in Corinth is not a place of love. Love is patient and kind, yet they wouldn't wait for everyone to show up at church before they started feasting themselves, leaving many to go hungry, even while claiming to be taking the Lord's Supper. Love does not envy or boast, yet in Corinth, they were boasting constantly about their abilities or their knowledge, using those to show that they were a better Christian than others who were there. Love is not rude, insisting on its own way, irritable or resentful, and yet many in Corinth were more interested in their own rights. What am I allowed to do, even at the cost of other Christians? Even if it meant that they were leaving others to question their faith? Even if it meant that people were leaving the church because of what they saw them doing? Who cares? I'm allowed to do it. Love does not rejoice in wrongdoing. Well, they were doing things that even the non-Christians would have been disgusted by. Rejecting the truth of God for what felt good. Love bears, believes, hopes, and endures all things. Well, if something went wrong with these Christians, if there was a disagreement that broke out in this church, well, I will see you in court. And because of that, as I was reading through it, I don't think Paul is giving us an exhaustive list. Top 15 things that love entails. I don't think he's telling us everything that love means in this letter. Even as he's given us this beautiful description, I think he's applying what love is like, ought to be like for this Corinthian church. The places that they have not been loving, Paul is showing this is instead what love is. I think he's pulling from a bigger idea and bringing it to this context to help them see this is what you are to be known as and this is what you have not yet been. Rather, I think the bigger idea that Paul is getting at is a question that we can and ought to be asking all the time that we gather. What are we doing with our actions, our affections, our whole being to seek what is right and good for those in the church? What does love look like? It is using our actions, our affections, our whole beings to seek what is right and good for those in the church. So if Paul was writing a 1 Corinthians 13 letter for us here at Calvary and Thornton, what would he say love is like for us? Where might we be missing this idea here? Certainly, I think there'd be quite a bit of overlap. If we are people who are short on patience with one another, then the idea that love is patient is going to be corrective for us. If we live our life, set up our entire existence for just ourselves, or maybe we broaden the circle just a little bit for those that are blood relatives or our close friends, but if you're not part of that, if you're not in this tight circle, you're just going to get scraps. You're not going to get my best. You're not going to get my attention. That's just for here. That's just for who I live with. If that's our idea of who we are to love, then this idea that love does not insist upon its own way is going to be convicting for us. Or maybe we love others for the benefit that we get. You know, love in return or status or they owe us a favor or whatever it might be. And miss the fact that people are going to let us down. And the idea that love is not irritable, resentful, is going to cause us to change course. If we only love those that are easy to love, the charge that it bears, believes, hopes, and endures all things will categorize it as more than anything else in this life. But what would Paul write to this church? What would Paul write to you about the places that we might be missing looking what is right and good for those in the church? Where might our thoughts, our actions, our affections be directed at something other than the building up of this place to be known by its love for one another? Because this is how Christians are to be known. More than anything else, we are to be known by our love. And not just for those that are easy to love, but for all of us. Not just for those that we already have a relationship with, but all of the church loving all the church. And not just for those that we can get a tangible benefit from or get something in return for it. Even if we've never received anything from them, have no hope of receiving something going forward, the church is called to be loving with all of ourselves. That is what we are made for. We need this. That is what you were made for. You need this as well. I was made to love those in the church. The church was made to love me. This is our design. This is what we're here for. But it doesn't quite get to that attainable aspect of this. We talked about how this can sound like it's hard to grasp, hard to understand. What does this actually look like? And as we read even just these 15 descriptions of what love is like, it doesn't feel like anyone could do that. How do we be perfectly kind and patient and loving? How do we do this for one another? There's certainly times that that's not going to describe us. Or other people take it as, all right, so I got 15 things to work through. I'll make a checklist. I'll go one by one. I'm going to work on patience till I get that down. I'm going to work on kindness till I get that and just create it as a list. And that's not going to be love. We can have the actions, the behaviors down right. But remember, it's not just what we do. It's our affections as well, our feelings, our desires. If those are divorced, then it's not going to be love. So how then do we love in this way? How then do we do this? If it sounds so difficult, if it takes all of our lives to show what is right and good for others, if it's something that's hard to produce within ourselves, how do we get the affections and the behaviors to work together in this? Well, the reason why we're able to love like this, why this is what Paul is given to us, real affection, real actions that are driven towards others, it's possible. Not just something that we pretend to have, not just something that we fake it until we make it on it, not just something that we need to try really, really hard to be people who love. The reason why Paul says this is what the church is to be, this is what we're able to do, how we're able to love in this way, is because the church consists of people who have already been loved. 1 John 4:9, we love because he first loved us. John writes here that not only is our motivation of loving one another is because we have been so loved by God, but it's this entire idea that this is possible. Us able to love with our affections and our actions is able and possible because of what's already been given to us. We're not asked to produce something that we don't yet have. We're not asked to create something that we don't even know what it looks like for ourselves. We are able to love in this 1 Corinthians 13 way because we have been loved in this way. We don't need to generate something within ourselves, but we actually have a well, a source, a fount of love that we pull from, that we use, that is the very means of receiving love ourselves and giving love for others around us. Jesus speaks of this idea as well. John 15, Jesus says, abide in me, remain in me, stay with me, find your source in me, connect with me, and I in you. As a branch cannot bear fruit by itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. Your source of life, your source of love is in Jesus. Remain in him. I am the vine. You are the branches. Whoever abides in me and I in him, he it is that bears much fruit. For apart from me, you could do nothing. That speaks of all of life. That apart from being with Jesus, we can do nothing. But specifically, verse 9. As the Father has loved me, so I have loved you. Abide in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. Not just this idea of all of life can only happen if we stick with, remain in, connect with Jesus. The only reason why love is possible at all, love that is the makeup and description of the church, why that's possible is if we abide in his love. Connect with him, find our security in him, find our comfort in him, find our rest in him, connected with him. That is the only way that we can possibly have love, because the love that we receive from him is the love that we are called to pour out on others. The love with which Jesus has given us is the very means and ways that we can love others in this way as well. We say love is patient. Well, I can be patient with you because Jesus is and was and forever will be patient with me. We say love is kind. Well, I can be kind to you because the greatest act of kindness ever, Jesus entering into this world and dying a death that he did not deserve so that I can have life in him that I did not deserve. That act of kindness, it was done for me. So how could I not possibly be kind for you? For something lesser, smaller, easier than dying death for life. I don't need to be envious or boast or arrogant or rude or insist upon my own way because I see it's not about my own way. Jesus has given me all that I have. I'm rooted in him. I'm settled in him. What could you possibly do to take away from that? What could I possibly do to use from you to get more than that? All that I have has been given to me in him. Therefore, I don't need to be irritable or resentful. I don't rejoice in wrongdoing and so go against Jesus, but instead rejoice in truth because Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. Instead, with you, I'm able to bear and believe and hope and endure all things because of the one who is working all things for my good. It's a reminder as well that Jesus didn't do any of this because I was so lovely, because I was easy to love. I'm very much so aware that that's not true. Jesus didn't do any of this because of what I did to earn it or deserve it or whatever it was. By his very first act, very first decision, he loved me. He loved you. And that is why he does all of this. And when that is our realization, that we have this God of love who is constantly, always loving towards me, as I join in with him, as I abide in him, as I remain in him, what other possible result is there than to live like this one who loves? Then as I'm remaining in him, to begin to be more like him, well, the natural outworking of that is to love like this one who has so loved me. That we don't need to plead. We don't need to question. We don't need to demand, I want to know what love is, and I want you to show me. So all we need to do is go to these commands, go to this word of God, and we see page after page after page after page of God showing you what love is. God showing you how he has loved you. God showing you a template with which we're able to do our small mimicry of loving one another as well. Because we have this Jesus we abide in. This Jesus who has so loved us that to be with him means that we become people who love as well. Let me pray for us. Father, we said it last week that when we look at what you are like, how you are described in the Bible, we see acts of your loving. We see ways that you act out of love, and yet that does not do enough to describe who you are. It says quite clearly, God is love. It's not just what you do. It's not something that is a part of you on occasion, but you in your nature is perfectly, eternally love. For us to be like you, to be children who look like our Father, then it's the natural understanding that we are to love as well. That is what describes us. For us to be your people, we must be like you, and you are love. And yet the call is not to try really, really hard to make this what we're known for. The call is not to go through a checklist to see maybe we'll be more loving after going through this. But the idea is that as we remain in you, abide in you, you are transforming us. You are continually pouring out love on us more than we could ever possibly need. And out of that overflow, out of this nature of being connected with you, that's where love comes from. That's how this is possible. Because we see the way you love us. We feel the way you love us now. And so that is what shapes us and describes us and marks us in this life now. Let us be people who are known by love, because we are people who've received so much love. So it's to you and you alone we pray.
Thanks for joining us for our series, Undivided. If you found this video helpful, click the like button and subscribe to our channel. It helps more people discover resources like this from Calvary Bible Church. Learn more about us at calvarybible.com and join us again next week as we discover our identity, purpose, and unity in Jesus Christ.